Hello and welcome to the Alt Trademarks Podcast. I'm your host, Hannah Salmendinger. On this episode, I was joined by Jenny Odegaard and Nakia Hansen. Jenny and Nakia work together at Odegaard Law in Brooklyn, New York. The firm specializes in providing legal services for creative professionals. Jenny and Nakia have tailored their practice to their clientele by offering non-traditional forms of communication and transparent pricing. You can find out more about the firm online at odegaardlaw.nyc, that's odegaardlaw.nyc. You can also find out more about Alt Legal on Twitter at altlegalhq and at altlegal.com. Thank you for joining us and enjoy. Hi, Nakia and Jenny. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So you both work at Odegaard Law in Brooklyn, and I definitely want to learn a little bit more about that practice and the work that you're both currently doing. But as a way of background, I want to learn a little bit more about how you guys got into law and how you got to where you are today. So to get started, can you just give me an idea of how you both became interested in the law initially?
So we both went to law school with the idea of working in public interest law. Nakia and I both have a background working in nonprofits and social justice issues. So that was kind of the original intent. For me, I graduated from college with a liberal arts degree and was a little bit frustrated after graduation that I had very little credibility or power, and getting a law degree was a good way to get a little bit more of that and find a way to contribute and help people on a higher, more direct level.
Yeah, and for me, it's a similar type of direction. Really wanted to see how I could be helping people. I had done some work in DV and in some other nonprofit spaces, and it seemed like what would be more helpful instead of that type of work would be gaining a specialized area of knowledge that people were really lacking access to. And so I started out in law school with that whole public interest focus, and then went on to be interested in lots of different areas of the law. But I think like most people, we were both driven to the profession with a desire to help people and be an advocate. So that was really essential to becoming a lawyer.
And Nakia, before you teamed up to work with Jenny, you did a lot of work in digital and social media strategy. So how did you get involved in that field? And is it something that you feel like those skills have helped you in working with creatives in the law and the work you do today?
Yeah, the way I got into that was sort of happenstance. I always say, you know, if anybody's familiar with the legal hiring market around 2008, 2009, that is how I got into digital social strategy. So graduated, was looking for something to do, and I already had that background, more of an interest in doing social media. I was always one of the first folks on a different social network and sort of taught myself how to use it. So I started doing social media strategy and building up the teams in different communications departments for a couple of large nonprofits, such as Planned Parenthood and the College Board, and grew those social media programs into significant pieces of the communications strategy. And then I started doing that a little bit more for law firms, for individuals. I did some consulting. So it really started out as a necessity. What else can I do? And I found it so interesting, so fun, really able to turn it into an alternative career. I think the way that it was helpful, or that the way that I do find it helpful working with the clients that we have today, is being familiar with content development, familiar with the channels in which they tend to operate. So lots of our clients promote themselves through social media, or their work is directly tech related. And so having done some of that work and met people in that space lets me know where they're coming from and some of the challenges that they face. So it's easier to think of some of the more novel legal ideas in that realm and make it relevant to the interests and needs of the client.
Oh, that's interesting. And we'll touch on that a little bit later in the interview. I want to talk about some of the work you do with these kind of brand influencers. But before we get to that, Jenny, you were at Find Law before you started Odegaard Law. So what was that experience like, and did you learn anything that you found particularly helpful when you decided to branch out on your own?
Working at Find Law was actually so interesting and very challenging. As Nakia said, working in marketing was really great to get a sense of what it is that our clients do and what issues that they face. So Find Law, because it is primarily a legal marketing organization, gave me a lot of experience in the day-to-day of putting together a marketing strategy and then implementing whatever that strategy is. My role there was in social content for small and mid-sized firms. So I learned a lot about the conventional wisdom and industry standards around legal marketing itself, which is an always evolving place. And at the time, there was a real rush for firms to get on social media and use all the new tools. But there wasn't necessarily an understanding of how to do that in a way that customers really wanted to engage with. It was just kind of, we have a Twitter account, and we know that Twitter is important, and we're just going to say something. So that experience has made me be really thoughtful about what kind of content we put out there and what is a meaningful way to engage, because this is such a small firm. We do have personal relationships with all of our clients, how we can translate that into a marketing strategy. So it's no accident that we didn't write a blog post for the firm until like 6 months ago.
And this question kind of leads into that, and it might have sort of answered itself, seeing as you both have a strong background in social media and in those realms. But I had actually heard of Odegaard before we set up this interview because of your website. You have a really amazing website. I think it's been featured on a couple blogs, and it really stands out in comparison to a lot of other legal websites. So before we get into the more substantive side of your practice, what's the story behind that website, and how did you decide that that was, I'm sure now it's a useful marketing tool, but how did that come about?
So the website was a collaboration with me and my friend Eric Price, who I went to college with. He's a designer who works mostly in the art world. And so he has a really great aesthetic and sensibility in terms of what people who we want to reach care about. The goal and the key for the website was not making it look necessarily to conform to standards within the legal industry, but to conform to standards and sensibilities in design and marketing. Because a lot of our clients have an arts background or a design background, and they're not going to respond well to something that looks too formal or that doesn't work on their cell phone or, that just has words and terminology that they can't connect with. So the goal of the website was really just to make it usable for people and accessible. And I give Eric all the credit for the beautiful color palette and the design and everything that makes it so very visually pleasing.
He definitely, it definitely, it stands out. It really pops when you open it, especially when you're flipping through other legal websites as a distinguishing factor. And for both of you, the practice, as you already kind of mentioned, focuses on consulting and legal services for creative professionals. So what drew you both to that particular set of clients?
For me, I think that this type of client is most attractive and great to work with because, first and foremost, it's just fun work to do. One reason I was never pulled toward doing a big corporate law job is because I didn't want to act for clients who I didn't believe in, who were doing work that was contrary to things that I believe in. So when you're working with fabulous beauty bloggers and gallery owners and boutique owners and all of these different types of folks who are working on really cool projects, it's fun to see them create and grow with your help. And then also, I think a lot of the clients, as Jenny mentioned, are people that we have personal relationships with. So they are our friends. They're the kind of people that we interact with on a daily basis in our regular friend circle, musicians, artists, designers, writers. Hearing their concerns and seeing the things they were going through as they began their creative businesses or they were in a stage of growth and transition really spoke to us and let us know that there were ways that we could be of help, and that there were, I mean, being based here in Brooklyn, there are tons of other people just like that. So we knew there would be a good stream of clients to work with, and that they would be doing projects that we could get behind and be really proud of.
Yeah, I definitely agree with all of that. For me, the very first client for Odegaard Law, the firm, and for me as a lawyer, was just friends of mine who I was talking with at a party, and they had kind of gotten themselves into a pickle with a big project that was really important to them, and they were trying to figure out how to save the business relationship, save them their hope of making any money at all, and kind of move forward with it. And through those kinds of casual conversations, you know, everything that kind of led out from that, it really became clear that a lot of other law firms aren't catering to these types of businesses. So it's a great opportunity to start something new. And I think for both of us to carve out some space as young lawyers, as people who are engaged with this community, to make a different type of experience for creative professionals who need the resources of the law.
And when you were getting started with those first couple of clients, was there anything that surprised you about kind of branching out on your own and starting a practice, or anything that you kind of had to learn the hard way and in retrospect, it, you know, you wish you would have known when you started that journey?
So many things. I think the biggest thing, and weirdly the most difficult thing, has probably been building up the forms library from scratch. I always knew that the contracts needed to be readable and well-designed so that people would actually be able to use them. So getting forms from friends, finding things in books, buying things online, and then adapting those to be useful for a clientele that they maybe weren't originally written for. I mean, a lot of the basics and conventions of contract drafting can be phrased in a way that's a little inaccessible or outdated. And we have found almost universally that if a client can read and understand the contract, they're going to be very hesitant to use it and to pass it along to their client. So getting the forms library in a place where we're confident that we can explain it to the client, they can understand it, and they can take it and use it and make it like a part of their toolkit was definitely the biggest challenge. And it's something that we're always still working on.
And this is sort of tied to that, but do either of you find that there's any common issues or pitfalls? I know you're talking about, you know, maybe they won't pass along a contract if it's not clear to them, but is there anything in particular that you find that these kind of creative clients, you know, just tips that they should all know, or things that you find a lot of them overlook, or, you know, just kind of any general things that keep popping up in your practice?
Yeah, one thing that pops up quite frequently, we find that a lot of the clients tend to have different informal or handshake deals in place. You know, they work with other creatives and friends to get things done. Maybe early on in the process, things were done on a favor basis, quid pro quo. So they just never got finalized. And I think it's hard for some of those clients to introduce contracts of any kind into a friendly relationship. But as they begin to grow, as they start to transform into a more sophisticated business operation, we try to help them understand that formalizing those agreements are really the best way to maintain friendly relationships, because things are spelled out, there's no misunderstanding, and so it's easier to avoid potential conflicts as opposed to just saying, oh, you know, that was my friend, they designed it, it'll be no big deal, like, they'll never come after me for anything. And it's like, great, that's the way we all hope it will work, but let's just get it down on paper, make sure everything is fine. And we try to do that, like Jenny said, in a way that is easy to understand, is as non-confrontational as possible, so that people feel at ease conveying that to their vendors and friends and collaborators. But just constantly we're seeing people who have some sort of, if not the whole deal, part of the deal is just, okay, well, that's fine. I know that person for years. Don't worry about it. We don't have to add that. And it's like, no, please let us add it. It'll just make us feel better. And you can tell them it was our fault. We'll be the bad guy. We're happy to do that.
We're always offering to be the bad cop to help people make that move from handshake agreement to a better, kind of more formalized working relationship.
Right. And additionally, I mean, this may be the piece of advice is just sign a contract, but are there any key pieces of advice that you, you know, in addition, find yourself offering over and over or, you know, stressing to them in particular?
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily advice, but just we let the clients know that we are there for them, that we have an open door policy, give us a call, you know, send us an instant message, just try to be as accessible as possible so that they don't hesitate to get us involved. You know, some people are concerned about cost, they're concerned about time or overcomplicating matters, so they don't want to get the lawyers involved. But being flexible with our time and offering a payment structure and terms that don't intimidate clients really lets them know that it's fine to reach out to us before they're embarking on something new, or if they're unsure about next steps, need another pair of eyes on a document or want to copy us on an email. That way we're always in the loop and able to advise on things before they get too hairy or too complicated. Sometimes you'll find that clients really want to go ahead on the down the deal path themselves quite a bit before they bring in counsel. And we just like to be kept in the loop early on and really let people know that we're accessible for them to do that at any time. So just stress that constantly. And it's worked out. I think people, since we do have a very collegial relationship with the clients, they feel comfortable in doing that and don't feel intimidated as some people can be by the attorney-client relationship.
Yeah, we try to make it really easy. We, you know, invite people to GChat and we accept text messages or quick phone calls. Just, you know, to Nakia's point, like the best thing that we think small businesses can do is just try to spot things before they happen and avoid conflicts. And that's like what we're all about. That's what we're always trying to get people to do.
That's great. I think it's so true that people, you know, they're just a little hesitant. Bringing in a lawyer seems like this big, scary step, but really it's, you know, in their best interest. And it doesn't have to be as scary as they think it is. One thing that I wanted to review a little more specifically is unique challenges facing influencers. So it's something that I understand you guys work with in the practice a little bit. So as a way of review, can you just speak a little bit on what it means to be an influencer? And if there's any sort of unique legal issues or just maybe the ones that are most common that usually arise for those types of individuals?
Yeah, sure. So broadly, an influencer is someone with influence or sway over the ideas and behaviors of others. So typically, you have an influencer that's been compensated, paid, provided with free products, or have had the production costs paid by a brand to create content that trades off of the reputation and influence of that influencer, be they a celebrity, a blogger, an Instagram personality, whatever you want to call it. So it's the system that's all built upon trust, and it's the trust that's been developed by the influencer over time, and it's that trust that makes them a credible advocate for lifestyle choices, trends, and products. So there are like thousands or maybe millions in the case of some celebrity influencers, thousands or millions of people that pay attention to what they're saying about anything, fashion, food, beauty, travel, home decor. So this, all of this makes influencers very attractive to advertisers and brands. It's also what's making regulators pay increasing amount of attention to them and what they're doing. So some of the issues that come up, I mean, you've got like, you've got the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, you've got the Federal Trade Commission. They're already tasked with reviewing advertising and product claims, right? And now they're looking at influencers who use digital media channels to influence purchasing decisions and the brands that enlist them to do that. There are issues with making false claims, improper disclosure of the relationship between the brand and the influencer. There are potential IP issues. So there are a number of things that can come up in regards to the relationship. There are a number of players of the chain. You've got the influencer. They're at various levels of sophistication in terms of how they're dealing with brands and managing their own contracts and knowing their value. you've got influencer networks sort of in the middle, who are the middleman gathering a bunch of different influencers and sort of brokering the relationship between the influencers and brands. Agencies often step in at the next level. And then you have the brand themselves. But it's like a hierarchy, but it also can be quite circuitous. It just really depends on the nature and the setup of a particular brand influencer relationship. But within that, in between all of those different relationships, a number of legal issues that are regulatory and intellectual property related can crop up.
And can you speak just a little bit more to some of the specifics as far as IP goes, like some of, I mean, maybe just from a high level, some of the mm-hmm. most common issues that arise?
Yeah. So some of the things that come up, I mean, just in general, with the digital nature of the communications, I mean, most of these influencer posts are happening on Instagram, Periscope, Facebook, I mean, just any number of different social networks, for the most part, blogs. They carry some of the traditional IP areas of concern, trademark, copyright, publicity, right? So what we're doing is counseling clients on how to be the best stewards of their own intellectual property, taking a look at the agreements that are presented to them to ensure that any use of names, logos, branded content, et cetera, are limited in use in scope and time for use with a particular campaign. So it varies from campaign to campaign, and it varies based on the value of the IP that the particular influencer has amassed thus far, but they might want to make sure that their likeness, their logos, and brand names are limited to certain uses, as well as the company, the brand that they're representing. They might be submitting some branded content and allowing use of certain logos and things like that need to be hammered out in various agreements. There's also the fact that influencers tend to own the content they produce, and they license it to the brand for limited use. So now we're involved in making sure that the licensing terms in particular contracts are favorable to the client when the client is the influencer. And at times we also work with agencies that are hiring influencers. So it might be needing to massage the terms that are favorable in that direction. And this also brings up issues of producing sponsored content. Like, I feel like more and more you're seeing brands that are not just asking influencers to just make a post and let it go, but they're creating custom content and asking the influencer to star in it. So that brings up some issues because the influencer now has added their creative input into the video or whatever it is, live streaming and images. So the usual IP issues come into play. It's just a new application for those, and making sure that the influencer understands going in what their responsibilities are and what it is that they want to end up protecting ultimately for their brand.
And I'm sure this issue is just going to have increasing relevance as social media continues to grow and it becomes more pervasive and more brands are engaging in non-traditional forms of advertising. I've certainly seen what you're talking about. I saw a sponsored ad with a celebrity in it on Instagram, you know, maybe an hour ago. So do you have any advice for any either influencers who are looking to kind of strike that balance or who are, you know, unfamiliar with the many, it seems, potential pitfalls, or for just any attorneys who maybe are going to end up seeing more of these issues cropping up and they're going to need to counsel these types of clients?
Yeah. First things first, I think everyone involved, influencers themselves and attorneys, should familiarize themselves with the FTC's Native Advertising Guide and the Endorsement Guide. So these things are available, like just Google them and they'll pop up. Not too clunky, pretty easy to understand. And they have laid out some guidelines for influencers and the brands that want to work with them. So just being familiar with those guidelines will let you know things about, you know, what counts as a material connection, the kind of thing you would need to disclose if a brand is providing you with product that you're going to review, if they've produced some of that content, et cetera. So it'll let you know when you need to add, you know, hashtag sponsored, hashtag ad, those kinds of things. That's all wrapped up in the endorsement guide. And there are some small differences, nuances between the endorsement guide and the native advertisement guide. So I think it makes sense for people to be familiar with both of those. But ultimately, what it comes down to, big piece of advice, is to disclose. So this is the part a lot of brands have trouble with, because no one wants to take the shine off of their post by adding hashtag sponsored, hashtag ad, or anything like that, that takes away from the fact that this could be a original, natural thought and opinion of the influencer, because ultimately that is what the brand is paying for and what they want to trade off of. But even though it may erode a tiny bit of authenticity from the post, it's really just not worth it to skip those kind of disclosures. The FTC has become increasingly vigilant about this, and they're handing down fines. They're making people retroactively add those type of notices to their posts. So if I had one piece of advice, it would be to disclose, but also you have to familiarize yourself with the guidelines so you know what you need to disclose about and when. And finally, I guess for lawyers working with influencers, maybe it'd be helpful to come up with a checklist, an easy thing that clients could use when they're creating their posts. Like, do they, you know, if this post involved products or services that I've used but I didn't pay for myself, you know, does that make a material connection, yes or no? If yes, I should use this hashtag. If no, you know, maybe some sort of checklist or flowchart. I find that kind of system helpful when I'm working with people. And when I'm following up on my own clients on Instagram, I like to just use that checklist myself to make sure they're doing the right thing. So that could be very helpful, not only for the lawyer, but for the client who in the day-to-day is the one responsible for putting up those posts.
Great. And I'll link to those guides that you mentioned in the show notes as well, so they'll be easy for people to find and refer back to. And to wrap up, we'll just do a lightning round of questions. So I'll just ask y'all a series of questions that have a little less to do with being an IP attorney and a little more to do with who you are outside of the practice. So they're just for fun. You ready?
Go for it.
Okay. What's the app that you use the most?
Instagram. We use it for fun, and we use it to check up on what our clients are doing. We really live on Instagram.
That's my most used app as well. I'm on it all the time. And who's a woman, professional or otherwise, that you both look up to?
Well, our official office kind of patron saint is obviously Beyonce. Nikki actually brought in a sign for her desk that says "Think Like Beyonce," so we try to always really internalize that.
Yeah, there are plenty of Beyonce lessons that can be applied to anything, especially the practice of law.
Yeah, she has a lot of amazing insights about how to practice law and how to advise your clients on influencer marketing guidelines.
Yeah, you know, she should be the patron saint of every law firm, really.
Definitely.
And where do you guys get your, or where do you like to get your legal news?
I'd have to say we get most of our legal news from Twitter. I spent some time cultivating lists and finding people to follow who bring a varied point of view into the timeline. So I can just turn on Twitter and see news about social media, news about influencers, about IP law, larger areas of law. So I really think Twitter is helpful that way. And that's where I get the most of my news. Probably also use some Google alerts. I check those not as frequently, but they always pile up on me, but I do have some set, and subscribe to a couple of Bar Association newsletters and things like that. But overwhelmingly, I think Twitter is our preferred news source.
Yeah, Twitter is a great place too to tap into the conversations that other lawyers and other small firms are having. So it's really interesting to discuss, you know, legal trends, issues in the business, and all different kinds of things that are coming up that are still really developing. And so finding out kind of what else is on people's minds and what the issues are that are coming up in practice is always really helpful as well, especially for a small firm where we have a focus group of two. Nice to expand our reach a little bit.
Great. And what's a great piece of advice or, your favorite piece of advice that you've received?
I think the best piece of advice that I received was from one of my law school professors who was helping me out a little bit when I first started the firm. He had participated a lot in drafting uniform commercial code provisions. And so when I was still on my own, I had reached out to him for a couple of questions on a corporate governance matter. And what he told me was be afraid enough to be very diligent and to, double check everything and do a great job, but don't let fear stop you from doing what you're doing. And that's been so helpful for me. And I think is helpful for every person who's thinking about starting their own firm, because there is a lot of that kind of duality where you want to do a great job and you want to be diligent, but if you go too far and you doubt yourself too much, you won't be able to accomplish this goal of having your own law practice, and you won't be confident giving your clients advice. So balancing the fear is just essential.
Yeah, that's a wonderful piece of advice. I'm sure that rings true to a lot of solos when they first are getting started. And last one is, what would you both be doing if you weren't attorneys?
Well, I guess I could go back to doing what I was doing previously, which is working in sort of digital social strategy, because those positions are always there and it's kind of safe. But if I was being truly honest with myself, if I weren't an attorney and I could magically have the skill to do this other thing, I'd probably be a dancer, preferably a background dancer for Beyonce. All roads lead to Beyonce.
I actually have, since law school, been working on a soup cookbook. So I would like to finish that and then be a YouTube soup chef.
That sounds good. Yeah, you also let us know when your cookbook comes out.
It's gonna come out never.
1990, never.
Okay, that's it. Thanks so much for joining us. Do you guys have any parting words of wisdom for the listeners?
Parting words of wisdom.
Okay, here's something. Here's a word to the wise for lawyers who want to get into working with a specific niche of clients. You really have to mirror what it is that those clients are doing. So we wanted to work with creative clients, so we made our firm look appealing to creative clients. We go where they go, we read what they read, and we don't do anything that's too traditional here because our clients are often non-traditional. So I think whatever it is, the niche that you want to go for, you should immerse yourself in that space and then mirror it as best you can while maintaining that air of professionalism that you always need to have as an attorney.
Perfect. And if any of the listeners want to reach out to you guys, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, they can always go to our website, which is odegaardlaw.nyc, and we are also on Twitter at odegaardlaw.
Perfect. And I'll link to both of those in the show notes as well. Thanks so much for joining us, you guys.
Thank
Thanks
you.
for having us.
That's this week's episode. Thank you for joining us, and see you next time.